I'm excited to do this one. There's a lot of fun stuff to talk about in Windows Azure Storage. Earlier in the week, well, yesterday, I guess it's not a very long week, yesterday I spoke about Windows Azure applications, building new .NET applications that you'll deploy on the Windows Azure platform, specifically the compute piece of the Windows Azure story, and we looked at how to do both web roles and worker roles and how to communicate between them using services, and we saw how to do some local storage within those things, but that's really just temporary stuff, how you save temporary files off within a Windows Azure application. But we didn't have time in that session to really look deep at how you would store data in Windows Azure itself. And I should point out that when you do Windows Azure Storage, you can do that without using all of that other stuff that I talked about yesterday. So you don't have to build an app for Windows Azure to use Windows Azure Storage. You may choose just to use storage. You may choose just to do storage to store files and things like data up in the cloud to simplify your own some of your own IT issues around data management. And you get a lot of those same benefits that we talked about earlier from doing just that. I'm with a company called Pluralsight. We have a booth out here. One of the things we've done over the last couple of years is we built this new on-demand training system called Pluralsight On Demand. And the reason I wanted to mention that right now is because we actually chose to store all the videos that we deliver to our customers in cloud storage. Okay, to be honest, we didn't use the Windows Azure cloud storage because Windows Azure didn't exist at the time. We built it 2 years ago. And so we chose to use Amazon S3. A lot of what I'm going to talk about here today is going to be very similar to what's available on the Amazon platform. They've really kind of caught up to Amazon. Amazon has been the leader in this space. Microsoft has done a really good job, however, of kind of catching up in terms of features and functionality. So it would be a different story if we sat down to start today, but a lot of what we've done to build this new thing that we have was the result of this new cloud invention. Had the cloud not been around a couple years ago when we started down this path, we may not have done it. We may have decided it's too much of a risk. We weren't sure what the business outlook would be like for this new type of training system, and there were a lot of unknowns. And so from a business perspective, it really made a big difference to us to be able to just piggyback on some other vendor and all the hardware that they had to try a new business model. So we only use cloud storage for that. We actually don't use other applications up in the cloud for that specific application. It's just storage, because all we really have are a lot of videos, and we need to store them somewhere, and we need to be able to deliver those to thousands of concurrent users potentially. And so, we got a scalability issue, we got a data management issue, we want to have backups and replication and all that kind of stuff. And that's all handled for us behind the scenes with Windows Azure. Well, sorry, not with Windows Azure, with S3 storage up in the cloud. So let's dive into this. You'll see that Windows Azure storage actually has a few additional capabilities that the competitors don't have. S3 has a pretty simple storage mechanism. They have, a blob-based storage mechanism, which is very similar to what you'll find in Windows Azure. And they also have kind of a simple queuing system. But they don't have the exact same notion of table storage that we're going to talk about here. Table storage is kind of a unique thing that Microsoft has done, and we'll talk about that and what's interesting about that. They also have this new thing called Azure Drives, which is kind of interesting. It basically gives you the ability to have an NTFS-like experience on top of blob storage, and which is really compelling, especially when you're talking about migrating existing apps that are built on NTFS over to the cloud. In addition to all of this stuff that we're going to talk about now, there's also SQL Azure, which is SQL Server up in the cloud. That's yet another storage option that you have. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about SQL Azure here, because this is really going to focus on the core stuff that's in the Windows Azure platform. But if we have time at the end, I'll kind of show you a quick demo of what a SQL Server database looks like that's provisioned up there in the Windows Azure cloud. Okay? So to start, the first thing you have to do is get a Windows Azure storage account. You need to go out to windowsazure.com and get a new account, and you can specify where you want your data to live in terms of data center locations. You'll notice we have data centers in the U.S. and in Europe and also in Asia today. But they're building new data centers as we speak all over the world. I know that just a few weeks ago I was in Dubai and they announced a new data center that they're going to be building in the Middle East. And it seems like just about every month they're announcing new locations for some of these data centers. Microsoft is very aggressively approaching this market to try to get coverage worldwide with these data centers. But right now today there's quite a few data centers in at least the U.S. and European regions. And so you sign up for an account and you kind of specify where you want to go, and it'd probably be better to just look at it. Let me jump over here to Windows Azure. Let me bring up a new window and just browse out to windowsazure.com. This is the main portal in case you haven't seen it yet. Just browse to windowsazure.com, and this is right where you can sign up. And then once you get signed up, bring that back. Once you get signed up here, you'll notice that you can create a storage account. So once you have a storage account, you can go into that storage account, and it will basically tell you some information about, you know, your specific storage account. You'll have an account name. In this case, I called my account Aaron Sconard, all one word. And so now we have these, I have these URLs that basically specify where my data is going to be up there, right? So if I want to address my data, whether it's blob, queue, or storage data, blob, queue, or table data, I mean, you can just, you know, use one of those URLs. You get a primary access key, you know, and there's lots of features here that you can enable. Okay? And so you have to get this set up first before you can really do anything else that we're going to talk about in this session. Once you have an account and you have, that access key, you have enough to get started, to sit down and start writing code, to use some of the tools that are available, to start playing around with your data, you know, up in the cloud. Okay, each storage account does have a limitation today of up to 100 terabytes, and there's a default limit of 5 storage accounts per Windows Azure subscription. So when you sign up, you'll create a Windows Azure subscription, and then within that, you can create different types of accounts, storage accounts and hosted service accounts, and that's basically what it's talking about here. Okay, so now what we're going to do is talk about the different types of storage that exist in Windows Azure. So we have these 4 things, which you've already heard me mention. Let me just briefly describe what each of them are. Table storage is basically structured entities. So you can think of them as big tables in the cloud where you have a set structure for those tables. You basically can have billions of rows of these entities. So if you think of it like in terms of the entity data model, that's really what we're talking about. You have an entity, you want to store it up in a table, and so you'll have a bunch of rows, and there'll be columns in that row for each of the properties that make up that entity. And on that table, you can specify what's called a partition key, which tells Windows Azure how you want that stuff to be partitioned across all the different hard drives that are out there in the cloud, because they're not all going to fit on one. If you have billions and billions of records, you need that stuff to get partitioned. And so behind the scenes, it's going to kind of take care of all that for you. You just have to annotate your data model and say, this is the data, and this is a really good key for you to go partition this stuff on, and then behind the scenes, it'll just go do it. And you get the benefit of being able to write rich kind of .NET link queries that are very natural, just like when you're working with, you know, the Entity Framework. But behind the scenes, you're actually talking to this cloud-based resource, this cloud-based database, essentially. Okay? So that's the table storage mechanism, and you'll want to use that for the structured entities that you store up in the cloud. It's not relational like SQL. Okay? That's one important thing to remember. You're not going to get the same kind of SQL relational guarantees or, you know, just any of that stuff that you might expect from SQL. There'd be limitations on the types of queries you do and how you do some of those queries. Okay, now there's also queues. Queues is kind of a core piece that we need to communicate between the different roles within our app. So within a particular Windows Azure app, we might have some, you know, some ASP.NET apps running. We might also have some worker applications running, and they need to talk to each other. Queues provide a reliable way for doing that. You can store a message in a queue, and it can just fill up with messages. And then when your worker applications have time, when they get, you know, resources available, they can go and pull those things off the queue to process that work request that came in. So queues are very commonly used for inter-app communication in a reliable way. Then we have blobs. Blobs are basically just unstructured data, just streams of bytes that you're going to go stick in buckets up in the cloud. So you identify what's called a container, and you say, I've got this container called photos. And then you just upload all your photos into that container, and each one gets a unique ID, which is the URI, the URL for accessing that particular resource once it gets up there into your Windows Azure Blob container. Okay, so it's very simple, very straightforward. That's very equivalent to the Amazon S3 thing that we're using for our videos. Okay? And then finally, we have what's called drives. And again, drives are basically this way to put NTFS on top of blob storage. So what you do is you create a blob, a big blob, and you go stick it up there in your container. And then within your app, you can go into the app and actually mount the drive, mount that blob as a Windows drive. And then it will treat it like an NTFS drive, and you can write to it using all the system.io APIs that you're very familiar with. So then your app can just keep working like it always has. Okay, and you can snapshot that drive and then download it to do backups, and you know, you can unmount that drive if you want to, and you know, it works just like a drive in Windows. It's kind of interesting. So that gives you just a better experience, or I shouldn't say better, but a more Windows-centric experience on top of a blob inside of a running Windows Azure application. Okay? So we're going to walk through each of these. We're going to take about, you know, 10 minutes to go through each one of these four things. With each one, we'll take a second to write some code and do some demos and see how this stuff works. And then at the end, like I said, I'll show you a complete application. And if we have time, I'll do a quick example of SQL Azure, too. So let's dive into tables. So you have an account. Within an account, you define these entities, your tables, that are going to exist within Windows Azure. Each table will consist of entities, and those are your rows. Each entity will consist of a bunch of properties, and those are the columns. Okay, so that's the general structure. When we talk about these things, that's how you can think about it, and pretty straightforward as far as that's concerned. So these are massively scalable tables. They were designed indeed to be partitioned to allow for billions of entities and terabytes of data. And that means that your data will indeed live potentially across thousands of different servers as things grow over time. Okay, that obviously comes with some consequences when you think about queries and performance and some of those issues. But it does give you that capability for free. You no longer have to worry about kind of designing that in to your infrastructure and into your own database solutions. Okay, it's designed to be highly available and durable. So your data is replicated several times across physical hardware and potentially even across data centers, you know, in case a data center as a whole gets taken out. And so you have, you know, that's what you're paying for. That's basically what, you know, you're buying into when you use something like this. All of those IT challenges just kind of go away. That's the theory. That's the promise. That's the business model. Right now, in terms of how you program it, it's actually really easy because they just piggyback on the ADO.NET data services programming model in .NET 3.5. Okay, so you basically just use that. You have your .NET classes that you use with ADODS, and you annotate them, and the rest is just link, okay? But the beauty is, someone who's not using .NET doesn't have to switch over to .NET to do this. If they want to access that data, or you want to, obviously it's your data, you're going to probably do this if you need to, but if a business partner needs to come in on a different platform, or you need to come in on one of your Linux systems, you can do that just using REST. The whole thing is exposed as a REST-based API. The reason why ADODS works so well is because of that, because we know that ADODS is a RESTful framework, right? So they've just got all that stuff built in to support that programming model straight away. So it's very natural to get started with this table storage as a .NET developer. Okay? So when you create a table, you know, that table name will be scoped by your account name, and that particular account can have as many tables as it wants. And then within that table, you're going to have this set of entities. On each entity, there's a few required properties that everyone has to have: partition key, row key, and timestamp. And those are important because Windows Azure relies on those things to figure out where to go put the data, how to partition things, and how to, you know, what the units of scalability need to be for your particular data model. So in the end, what you'll do is you'll just derive from a special base class and inside of the programming model in .NET, and then it'll provide you with those three required properties, the base class will. So then you just define your own properties on top of that. But if you were coming at it from the REST API, you would have to make sure that you always provided those three required properties. Okay, so again, partition key and row key are important because they're what ultimately uniquely identify an entity. That's the primary key. The combination of those two things is the primary key for a row in table storage. Okay, that defines the sort order, and that's what we use to scale the app and to figure out where things go. Things within a single partition will always remain together. Okay, so the partition key is again what makes sure that happens. When I say together, I'm talking about physical infrastructure, like where that data resides within the data center. Okay? Now, we've got a picture here to kind of illustrate this. Let's say you have a table that looks something like this, where you've got the partition key, the row key, and then we've got a timestamp and release date and a bunch of other, you know, movie information. This is a movie table. And notice the partition key is actually our category property. Okay, we've decided that the category in our data model is a good way to kind of break up the data. So that's the category of movie or film that we're talking about here. And then we have the title, which should be unique. So the combination of the partition key and the row key gives us our primary key, and that's what the structure would look like. And then when Windows Azure goes and actually stores this out in the storage fabric, it's going to then figure out kind of where to put stuff based on these values. And it may turn out that it gets split, you know, somewhere in the middle, say right up to the animation right there, and then in the end, we end up with the data split across two different servers. You know, the first partition is going to contain everything from action to animation, and then the other server will contain everything from comedy on down. And that's the idea here. So we don't worry about how that happens. We just, you know, design our data model with that in mind, and we think about, you know, what is the right partition key. That is going to be kind of one of the most difficult things to get right in terms of the design of this cloud-based data model. Okay, then on the table itself, there's an API, and you know, for the table storage service, there's several operations that you can perform. At the table level, you can create tables, you can delete tables, and you can query tables. Those are the three operations for dealing with tables. And then for entities, we can insert entities, we can update, we can delete, we can query them, and we can also do, this is a new feature as of the final release, this just showed up as of, you know, the final PDC V1 release, the notion of an entity group transaction, a way to basically, you know, group some operations into the scope of a logical transaction. Okay, so with that in mind, let's just jump over here to Visual Studio. and take a look at a complete example. So here in Visual Studio, I have this is just a simple console app, okay? So this console app just has a main here. We got a bunch of functions we're going to go build out, and we're going to look at how to write some of this code. But the first thing I need to do is get set up with the API. I've already added a reference here in Visual Studio to a couple of key assemblies. Over here, you'll see the Microsoft.WindowsAzure.Storage client assembly. That comes with the Azure SDK. So once you have that thing installed, you'll have access to these assemblies. And there's also another one for the cloud drive stuff. The drive stuff I'm going to do at the end is part of a separate assembly. So you'll want to make sure you use that. You bring that assembly in if you're going to do any of the cloud work. If you're just doing tables, queues, and blobs, you just need that one assembly. And so what that comes with is a few key classes that you'll use on the client side to program against these REST APIs. There's a cloud blob client, a cloud queue client, and a cloud table client. And we're going to use that table one right now. And so the first thing we have to do is figure out how to create one of these things and hook it up to my account, right, somewhere up in the cloud. And so the way you do that, I'm going to jump over here to this other class that I've already got implemented. And you'll notice here I've got a few, I call this class Storage Factory, and I've got a few constant strings here, blob storage URI, queue storage URI, and the table URI. And those are just pointing to my Windows Azure account. If I jump back over here to IE, those are the same as these right here. Right? So that's how you figure out what you're going to point your client-side APIs to. And then that primary access key is the one that, is basically our secret. So here I've got my account name and my key. And then with those two things, I can create what's called a cloud storage account object. Okay, and I pass in my credentials, which are the account and the key, and I pass in my blob storage URI, my queue storage URI, and my table storage URI. And then from this one object here, this cloud storage account instance, I can basically create instances of the cloud queue client, the cloud blob client, or the cloud table client. I can just create instances of those, use that as kind of my factory mechanism. So to show you what this looks like, I can just say, right here, let's just go ahead and create we'll call this my cloud blob client, and we'll call this, in fact, we'll just call this blob client for now, equals new, or sorry, I'm not going to do new, I'm going to say live account dot create, create cloud blob client, and that will create that thing for me, and then I can just return it. Okay? So I'll return the blob client. Okay, like that. And then someone can just use this class to go create one of these things, and all that stuff is just kind of encapsulated here. Now, this will cause that API to be hooked up to the cloud, up to Windows Azure, to my account up there. Additionally, I might want to also support, while I'm building this code, to do this through the dev fabric. Yesterday, in my first session, I showed everybody that Windows Azure comes with a built-in development fabric, which means you basically have Windows Azure right on your box within Windows, within Visual Studio. So here you'll notice if you go to the start menu, within the SDK there's this development fabric and a development storage. When you build Windows Azure apps, you can deploy them right into that development fabric on your desktop and test them and debug them before you go deploy them out to the cloud. You can do the same thing with this storage thing. So if we run this storage thing, let me just do that again, come back into here. So if we come into here and make sure the storage is running, and then we come over here, we'll see it in here, and we can say show the development storage URI. That's basically what it looks like. It's not really that exciting. But we see that those three services are running, and those are the URLs that they're running at. So I might want, depending on, my development cycle here, I might want to just, start writing all my code to that instead of to the live cloud. I can kind of decide and choose, right? So I might want to extend this method just a little bit here. So instead of just blindly returning one of these, notice I have this Boolean that's being passed in here to say, you know, do you want to use the dev store or do you want to use, you know, the real one? And so for what I'll do here is I'll say if use dev store is true, then I'll actually return, and there's a class here called cloud storage account, and there's a built-in account here for the development storage. So that's already initialized with the right, you know, addresses and the right credentials to log in to the development storage. So here I can just say create blob client from that. Otherwise, we'll do this. Does that make sense? And actually, we don't need to do that. We'll just return that. Okay? So we're basically going to follow that same pattern for everything. So let me just, you know, get rid of that to-do and just copy all this. So I'll bring this down here. And then here, instead of doing the storage account, we'll do the create table client for both of these. And then down here for this one, paste it in. And in this case, this is for the queue, so we'll do a create queue client. So now that we have these three things in place, it's going to make a lot of the other code easier that we have to deal with, okay, throughout the rest of the app. So that's just all here in this factory class for just basically creating that client-side API, initialized properly to connect to our account, and now we're ready to write some code. So if we want to get started with the table API, the first thing we have to do is define an entity. So here's my entity. It's a contact. And I've got a name, email, Twitter, and photo URL. Those are the properties that make up this entity. And notice I'm deriving this thing from table service entity. That's the base class you have to derive all these things from for table storage. And that will give me the partition key, the row key, and the timestamp properties. And notice that I'm initializing the partition key with a GUID. So what's that going to do? That means every single partition key is going to be unique, which means our data could end up all over the place, right? Azure's kind of free to store it wherever it wants. It doesn't have to worry about grouping anything. Okay, so that's good. It's fine for this demo. And the row key is just going to be empty in this case. So pretty simple model in terms of how we want the data partitioned. Then I have to author this contact service context class, which is basically what I'm going to use to connect with the service and start using it. And you'll notice here it takes a base address, it takes some storage credentials, and then it just calls the base constructor. And then down here we specify our table name, okay, contact table in this case. And then we have this property called contact table that returns an iQueryable, and that's going to create a query for me to deal with this data model. Okay, so with those two classes in place, then I can come down here, and once I have that model in place, it's actually pretty easy to just create a table from that model. So you'll notice right here I'm saying create table from the contact service context model, and there's a method call it's a static method on cloud table client called create tables from model. Okay, you just pass in that type along with the base URI and the credentials. And then it's going to go out there and actually create that table for us in the storage account. Okay, and so we're going to print out table created once that's done. Okay, and then down here, right above it, I'm going to actually add some rows to that table. So here, notice I'm just creating a bunch of contacts. Okay, and that's just typical stuff. And then after I've created three of these contacts, I come down here and I say table context, and by the way, that's up here. Table context is just a new contact service context, that class I just showed you, but I pass in the base URI and the credentials for the table account. Okay, so that's the thing we're using right here to actually add these objects in. So down here I just call add object, pass in the table name, and pass in the object instance, the entity that I want to add, and then at the end I call save changes. Okay? And then if I want to, you know, query and potentially delete some things, this is what my experience now looks like for querying. Notice it's just link. I'm saying, you know, from C and tablecontext.contact table, where the name equals Keith Brown, select C, That's going to go select Keith's record from the table. And then I can, after I execute that query, I can iterate through the results and do things. And in this case, I'm just going to delete everything. Delete all those things from the table. Okay? So let's just run these three things and see what happens. So I've got the table stuff down here. Let me just uncomment these. So the first thing we're going to do is create the table, then we'll add the rows to the table, then we'll query and delete the table. Now let's just get a visual of what this Windows Azure Storage account we're looking at here looks like right now, and how we've configured things. I need to go back to my desktop here. We come back here, and there's an application I'm going to use here called Cloud Storage Studio. It's from a third-party company called Celebrata, and they provide a couple of Azure tools. This is one of them. Microsoft doesn't provide any tooling out of the box. They do provide an MMC snap-in on CodePlex that you can go download. It's called the Windows Azure MMC tool. And it'll give you a UI on top of the blob, queue and table storage. But this one's a little nicer, so I like to use it. And so right now, you'll notice if I open this thing up, I can specify where I want to connect to, which source. So right now, I'm connected to my actual Aaron Sconard account out on Windows Azure. I've already got the credentials plugged in, and it knows that it's looking at those, and it's showing me the tables. Right now, I just got one table, and it's called Contact Table because I ran this before. Okay, so it knows that thing's there. But notice I can also connect to the development storage. That's one of the options that I can connect to. So if I click on that, it'll bring that in, and now I can look at all the tables within my development storage down here. Okay, so that's the storage thing running on my laptop. Okay, so you can connect to all sorts of different Azure accounts here. If you want to connect to a new one, you can always just say connect to one of these things, and then you specify the account information, the name, the account key, the saved connections, etc., and then it will remember that stuff for you in the future. Okay, so if I look at this contact table right now and I double-click on it, I can see there's a bunch of things already in here. There's a partition key. It looks like a GUID. We got a bunch of stuff there. There's some names, etc. So we've already got data in there. Let me just delete this table. I'm going to right-click and delete it. And by the way, when I'm using this app, this is just using that REST-based API to talk, to the Windows Azure Storage services. So you can write code to do this exact same thing. Every operation I do here is exposed as an API like that. So right now, that thing is empty. We have no tables in the system. Let's jump back here to Visual Studio, and we're going to run these three methods we just got done looking at. So let me go ahead and do a Control F5. Oh, sorry. I have the wrong project set as startup. Let me jump over here, set this as the startup project, and run the console app instead. Okay, so there it says it's creating the table created, deleting Keith Brown, and then press any key to continue. So if you remember, we added three records, and then we just deleted Keith's. So now we should only see two records up there. And if I jump back here, we got to remember which one we were talking to, right? So if I jump back here and look at how we wrote that code up here, you'll notice that I specified false here, which means what? I think if I remember right, if we come into here, we specified use dev storage. So if that was true, then we're going to use the local development storage. If it was false, then we'd actually put it up in the real live account. So let me just go ahead and check the real live account here, the one we just deleted it from, and there's our contact table back. I can browse in. You'll see those two records there, Aaron and Fritz. Keith is now gone. And I can, drill into these things and actually look at the structure, look at the data, and that's one thing that this tool, lets me do. Okay? So all that data that we specified made it up there into our storage account. So that's a pretty simple example of kind of walking through what tables look like and how they all fit together. So now let's move on and jump through and talk about queues. Queues are pretty simple as well. They work very much the same way. We have accounts. Within an account, we can have multiple queues. And then within a queue, we can have messages. The messages are just simple little messages. And they have to be pretty small. They can't be larger than than 8 kilobytes in size. Because if you need to store something more substantial than that, you should really just put it in a blob storage and put a reference in your message to that thing. Right? You don't need to put that whole thing in a queue. And because of the semantics around queues with reliability, that makes it easier for them to manage what's going on. Okay, so we have these small messages, we put them in queues, and it's just basically FIFO. You know, first in, first out, we can deal with things that way. So an account can create many queues, an unlimited number of queues, and then we can store as many messages as we need to within a particular queue. Okay, and then what we can do also is we can set a message expiration value as well. We can define when messages will time out. And when we go to read messages off a queue, we can also specify a visibility timeout. When one app goes in and retrieves something from a queue, we really don't want any other app to see that anymore. Right? If I have 5 instances of Windows Azure running at the same time, all pulling things off of the same queue, we want to make sure they're not duplicating the work. So as soon as an app pulls something off a queue, it'll go invisible for a period of time. And you can specify how long that time should be. You know, it needs to be longer than the amount of time it will typically take to perform that operation. And then if it fails somewhere along the way, that timeout will occur, and the message will show up back on the queue again for the next app to come and pick up and to try again. Okay? If you successfully finish doing what you need to do on the queue, then at that point, it's your job to actually delete it, to remove it from the queue. And that means no one else will see it again and it's gone. Okay? So on queues, we have a few simple operations. We have create queue, delete queue. We can list all the queues, and we can retrieve metadata for queues. Okay? And every queue we can associate metadata with, which is extensible. You can just attach, you know, name value pairs to these queues and read and write that at runtime as well. Then, obviously, we need messages that we put into the queue. So we have the notion of messages. We can add messages into a queue. We can get messages from the queue. We can peek. And, of course, we can delete. So very simple. I mean, I'm sure you've used queues before in other settings. Not a lot different about this. If I jump back here to the studio, you'll see here, if I browse to the queue section, I've got a queue here called My Dev Days. I've just got one queue right now. I'm going to come in here and delete this thing. So we've got no queues right now. And let's look at what it would be like to write some code to actually, not the right version. Let me jump back over here. Let's look at what it would be like to write some code to write to a queue. Okay, so let's comment these lines out now and just focus on the queue piece. Okay, so we're done with these. Down here I've got a few different methods for creating queues, for writing messages to a queue, and for reading messages and deleting them from a queue. Let's go ahead and create a new queue programmatically. First, what I'm going to need to do is get my queue, and you'll notice up here I've got a queue client that just calls create cloud queue client, that other class we just saw, and that'll give me a cloud queue client back that I can start programming against. So here, I'll say cloud queue client. Actually, I don't need to do that, do I? I've got one up above. Queue client. What am I thinking? And then here what I can do is, notice here I can get what's called a queue reference. This method here is pretty important. This is how you name it. Okay, so here I would say I want to create a new queue reference, my dev days queue. And then that's going to give me back, if you look here at the IntelliSense, it's going to give us back a cloud queue object. And then once I have that, I can make this method call create if it doesn't exist. And that'll return true if it created it or false otherwise. Okay, and that'll actually create my queue. So if I simply run this right here, let's just uncomment that one and run it, we should see it successfully ran. And if I jump back over here to the studio and I refresh my queues, we should see that queue is now in there. If we double click on it, notice it's empty. Okay, nothing's in there. But we now have a queue that we can start programming against. And then we can write a bunch of messages to that queue. And we can also read messages from that queue. In order to save some time, let me jump down here. Where is that right here. Write messages to the queue and read messages. To write messages to a queue, we're just going to say queue client. Actually, what I'll do is I'll go ahead and grab that queue like this, like I just did down below. And then I'm going to need a bunch of messages. Okay, so there's a, you'll notice here I say cloud queue, and I can, up here at the top, there's a method called add message. And here I pass in a cloud queue message object, and that's the main object for representing these things. Okay, and so what I'm going to do is just do a little for loop here. We'll do for int I equals 0, I is less than 10, I plus plus. And then for each one of these things, what we're going to do is we'll create a new cloud queue message. Okay, and notice you can just pass a string into it. So let's just do, you know, I to string. Okay, and then we can just add that message in here to the queue. Like that. Okay, let's just actually run that piece without actually reading anything off. Okay, and so it's going to go out there and now it's done, and it should have written those things to the queue. Let's jump back here and refresh our queue. And there are all of our messages. Okay, notice they all have a message ID, which is a GUID, and they have, you know, insertion times, expiration times, etc. And if I go in here and look at these things, you'll actually see the message. That one says 0. This next one should say 1. Let's just jump down here and see if this one says 9. You know, so those are our messages going into the queue. Very similar, you know, I mean, the UI, these guys actually made the UI look a lot like MSMQ. It's very, very natural in terms of how you work with these things. Okay, then we can read messages from the queue and delete them. And I'll just bring in some code for this one. If we come down here and just drop this bit of code in here, this does the same thing. It grabs a reference to our queue, and then it says, okay, I'm going to read this first message from the queue. Notice I can retrieve the approximate number of messages on the queue. And then I can just say queue.getMessage, and that thing will either return null or it will return me, you know, the next thing that's on the queue. So I'm just going to loop now and just say, while message is not equal to null, let's read that message off the queue. And then once I print that thing out, I'll then call delete message on the queue, passing in that message, the actual message instance. Okay? So now we're going to run it again. Now, how many should we see show up here? Should see 20. Right? Because we ran the thing twice. There were 10 added the first time, and now we got another 10 going in, 0 to 9 in both cases, and now we're done. So pretty simple example of reading and writing from Windows Azure queues. Okay, let's jump back here and talk about blobs. Blobs are, you know, same kind of model in terms of we have accounts, and within an account, instead of having queues, we have containers. These are the buckets. And then inside of these containers, we just have named blobs. You can think of them as named files, okay? And they can be anything you want. And you can specify metadata on blobs just like you can on your queues, and specify, you know, content type and things like that, so Windows Azure knows how to serve those things up when they're served out over the internet. So the URL will look something like this, your account name.blob.core.windows.net, and then within that, you specify your container name, and then you can specify your blob name, okay? And your blob name can be whatever it wants, and it can use paths in it as well, okay? So the account, the container, and the blob are the things that get provided by you when you go do this. So once you get something up there, depending on the permissions you set on the blob, you can set permissions on these things to control who can access them. But once they're up there, then you can just hand out these URLs, and people can just do a GET request to go pull down that blob. And the metadata that you associate with these blobs can be, you know, can be copied down and sent down in the HTTP response to the client. Okay, so you can have as many containers as you want, as many as will fit within the limit on the storage account. These are limited to, I believe, 100 terabytes of data. It's pretty big. There is a limitation, a physical limitation, though, today, but You know, that's the idea. And then a container can hold, you know, as many blobs as you want to put in it. It's really unlimited in that sense. As long, you know, as long as you have storage left, you can keep sticking blobs in there. And you can set your access policies on the containers. So on each container, that's where you go in and specify, you know, what you want to set. If I come back over here to the studio and I come to this container that we just created. So here we just... I haven't created one yet, have I? But I've got some containers laying around. I've got one here called Pictures. We're about to do this one. If I right-click on this and say Container Access Policy, this is where you can go in and set some of these things. All this is done over a REST-based API or through a tool like this, and you can specify, you know, if you want to have public read access and all this stuff or private access, and you can specify policies and who can read and write during specific periods of times and all that kind of stuff. So you can be pretty expressive about that. You can also right-click here and go in and look at the properties for queues or blob or containers. So I might come in here to my pictures blob and look at the container properties and notice there aren't any custom properties right now, but I could easily add some, just name value pairs that get put in there. Okay, and those will be associated with your blobs, you know, as long as they're up there in the storage. So let's actually delete this blob so we don't have anything right now. Let's get rid of it. And I'll jump back over here to Visual Studio. We're going to finish implementing the last few methods here. We just got done creating some queues. Now we're just going to list all the blobs that we have in our containers, and then we'll upload some pictures into a blob, and then we'll actually download one of those pictures from the blob from the account back down into onto our local machine. So before we do this, let's actually just assume we have a container already there called pictures, the one I just deleted. But it won't have anything in it right now. Sorry, let me close that. That was right. Okay, pictures, save container. Then it asks me straight away, hey, do you want to upload a blob into that container? Sure, let's do one for fun. So notice this tool is letting me do this as well. I'll just pick one of these, you know, upload it. Now it's uploading that thing to my account. Whoops, hit upload. And the green bar goes, now it's up there, we hit close, and if we jump back here and refresh this and jump back down into our pictures, we should see one blob there. Now, of course, I can right-click on this thing and say, okay, show me the URL to this blob. I'll copy that to my clipboard. And then I can actually just launch right to it if I want to in Internet Explorer, and there's that picture. That's being streamed down. If you look at the URL, that's coming down from Windows Azure. Right? That picture's now up there. It's now being rendered in my browser. You know, this is how our videos go out to all of our customers. It's just through a simple mechanism like this. Okay. So now let's do some of that via code. So if I jump back here to Visual Studio, and just looking at the time, instead of taking the time to write this, I want to make sure I can show you the complete example. So I'm going to jump down here and just list all the blobs by doing that. And so notice I first write out, I'm going to list out all the containers in my blob account. And I write out the blob account name here. That's all I'm doing there in that first line. Then I call blob client.listContainers. And that gives me back an IEnumerable of all of my blob containers. Okay, and then I can just for each through each of those within my account. And for each one, I'm going to write out the container name. Then I'm going to take that container and I'm going to tell it to list me all the blobs within it. And then that's what this for loop down here is doing. For each container, I'm going to call list blobs on that container, and then I just write out the blob URI so we can see that URI. Okay? And obviously, when we do this, if we had a lot of blobs, that could take a long time, right? So you can also search. You can list blobs based on a prefix. So typically when you go store things in a blob storage mechanism like this, you'll use path segments in your blob names. Even though you only have one top-level container, you will have the ability to have paths in those segments, and you use those paths to define your searches on top of the blobs. When you go list your blobs, you'll kind of use that as the mechanism to reduce the scope of what you're trying to get back, pretty much like you do with on a file system. Okay, so let's just go ahead... And let's put in the upload blobs as well. Here's what it looks like to upload a few blobs, just a couple lines of code for each one. I get my blob reference for the new blob that I'm going to create. Notice I'm putting that in pictures, and then aaron.jpg, and I'm going to just call upload file. That's the easiest way to do it. If you have a file on disk that you want to upload, just one call, and you specify, you know, the path to that file here on disk, and it's going to upload it to that blob reference that I just created. Okay, and then I have another blob reference here for fritz.jpg, another one for Keith. We upload all those and say uploads is complete. So let me look at the code up at the top again. Let's actually, let's comment this out now and come up here and let's list all the blobs. We'll upload blobs and then we'll list them again. We might as well finish off and just do the download blob all at once. Down here I've got that code. It's just a couple lines of code as well. You'll see here we get a reference to the container. We call get blob reference on the container, specifying which blob precisely I want to pull down. And then we just call download to file. That's the easiest way to do it. There's a few different ways you can do it. If you want to stream it down, you can stream it down. But this is just getting it in one shot. And then we just save that thing to file. And I'm going to call that aaronlocal.jpg. And we'll actually go find that in the directory on the disk. So we're going to run all four of those methods we just built. We'll list, we'll download, we'll upload, and then we'll list them again. Okay, so let's go and run it. So we see my thing has a few different containers, drives, pictures, and then this other one. And then we uploaded all the blobs, and then we listed again. If we come up here, you'll see right here is where we downloaded that blob. We just got done uploading. And then we say the download is complete. We uploaded some new blobs, upload is complete, and then we listed them again, and now we have four blobs in there. Notice the blob names are case sensitive because I've got Aaron with a capital A, Aaron with a lower A. Those are two separate blobs within the account. And that's the only container here, pictures, that has anything in it right now. If I jump back over to storage and just do a refresh here, we should see all those blobs in there now. There's the four blobs. Pretty straightforward. I can actually, and by the way, I can specify the content type on those blobs when I updated them, when I uploaded them. Notice how that first one says image JPEG. That's because when I uploaded it, I selected a JPEG file from disk. So this tool automatically added that metadata into the blob when it uploaded it. I can do that programmatically as well by just adding that metadata into the blob at runtime, but I'd have to add that code in. But notice I can just, you know, double click on one of these things. It's going to download the blob and display it. And again, that's what your customers will do once you get this stuff up there. Okay? So, and we also need to look at the directory on disk, right? Let's bring up Windows Explorer, and let's go into Dev Days and Storage and Cloud Storage Sample and Cloud Storage Sample right here and Bin and Debug, and there's Aaron Local. That's the one we downloaded just now. Okay, and if we double click on that, it's actually an image. Okay? All right. So we've seen how blobs work. And there's some new features they just added in the first release towards the end that are quite exciting. They actually have two different types of blobs now in the final release. They have what are called block blobs and page blobs. Block blobs are kind of like what I was just doing, where you have this block of data, and you just basically want to upload the whole thing at once. Right? You can chunk it down. You don't have to have the whole 100 gigabyte file in memory to, you know, get it all up there at once. You can chunk it down and send them in chunks, but the whole thing is done as one transaction, and you never, you know, randomly access the blob. You always grab the whole blob as a whole. That's not very convenient when you've got huge blobs that you need to kind of index, and you might only care about updating pieces of the blob, not the entire thing. So that's why they added in page blobs. Page blobs are a way to basically index into a blob, basically define pages, that can then be updated individually. So you don't have to update the entire blob every time. So page blobs are a very compelling new feature they added in that you should check out if you're dealing with huge, you know, pieces of data. They also have mechanisms to easily copy, snapshot, and lease blobs. They have a nice versioning story around these things now. You can walk up to a blob at any point in time and just make a copy on the server. Okay, and you can create a snapshot to do versioning. Say, I want to create this snapshot of this thing at this point in time, and then it continues to change and evolve, and you can always go back to that snapshot. Obviously, the more data you have in there, you know, the more you get charged. You get charged for by the byte, right? Every byte that's up there, you incur a charge. But this is all built in now. When we started with S3, with our videos, we had no mechanism to do versioning. We had to do all that stuff ourselves. We had to write kind of an architecture for how we were going to version our videos, and we had to write a bunch of code to kind of move things around and keep copies of things. So having that ability is actually very, very nice. The other thing they provide is the notion of a root blob container. So you can, you know, instead of having to always go in and access a container, there are situations where I just want to be able to say, you know, go to my account and pull out this stuff and kind of have the notion of a root drive. So you can specify for a container that you want a specific container to be the root of your account. Then it will be treated that way, which makes things a little bit simpler. And there's a few other features as well that have come. One of the big ones is the content delivery network thing. I want to jump back over here to the portal real quick. And let me go into my account. Actually, do I have that one up right here? Yeah, I do. So if you go into my account here and scroll down, you'll see there's two other key features that I'm talking about on the slide. They have this notion of a content delivery network. Right now it's disabled on my account, but I can just come over here and enable this. By just pressing that button, that one click, you can now enable all of your blob data to be replicated just like it would with a content distribution network like Akamai all over the world, right? Wherever Microsoft has data centers and edge locations. And it will just be cached automatically across all these different data centers, right? You don't get charged more. You do get charged more, but you don't get charged for every copy of it. There's just a different charge for how you get charged for the data that's being distributed this way. But it makes it really, really easy to get that stuff up and running. We're actually doing that. They have a similar feature on S3 called CloudFront. If you're working with Amazon Web Services, you can check that out. CloudFront is the name. And it does the same thing. You know, you just flip a switch, basically, and then it just happens. You have to use a slightly different URL scheme when you have the CDN stuff turned on. But, you know, it's just a matter of changing URLs. If you want some customers to just go directly to the data source where this stuff lives, you can give them the regular URLs to your data. But if you want the other stuff to go through the CDN network, through the edge locations all over the world, you give them the CDN URLs to your data. Okay, the other thing you can do, which is a very common question, is custom domain names. If you don't like, you know, to see blob.core.windows.net in the URL, you can set up a CNAME in your DNS server that maps from a custom domain name that you own over to your blob CNAMEs, and you just come in here and register it, create the mapping, and then behind the scenes, it'll just be taken care of. And then you can just start using your own, you know, custom domain names. We actually do that with our videos too, where the URLs you'll see will actually say pluralsight.com in them, but they are actually coming from Amazon through Amazon's S3 system. So that's nice. You probably want to do that in most cases. Okay, so a lot of cool stuff. Blobs are, you know, there's usually a pretty good use for these things all across the board. So just to finish that off, let's just jump back here to the slides and talk about drives. Okay, this is the last section. This one won't take too long. Okay, I've already talked about what drives are. It's this ability to basically map a drive onto a page blob. Remember what we talked about, the difference between blocks and page blobs? This is a mechanism to walk up to a page blob and basically, so you take a page, basically a VHD image is what it is. Okay, you can create a VHD in Windows 7 just in the disk manager. Just go in there and say, give me a new VHD. Then you upload that to your blob storage. You can use that tool I just showed you to do that. And then once it's up there, you just make an API call to mount that page blob as a virtual drive. And then you actually get a drive letter back. And then once you have a drive letter, you just use system.io to party on that blob, like it's NTFS. Okay, it's pretty cool. And then you access it just like you would a blob. And so all those features we talked about for blobs work here, too. So if you want to take a snapshot of that drive, you can just do a copy or a snapshot operation on the page blob, and then you can browse to it and download it. And then you got a backup of the drive. You know, and inside of your Windows Azure app, you're just, you know, executing it, dealing with it like it's a drive. Pretty darn cool. Okay? So there's methods, there's operations here for creating drives, mounting drives, unmounting drives, snapshotting drives, and copying drives. And let's just go look at a full example to see what this looks like. I'm going to jump back over here to Visual Studio. And I've got a different application here set up for this. This is actually a Windows Azure app. Okay, so I'm going to set this as my startup project now. And you'll notice here, instead of actually creating the VHD inside of Windows 7, I'm actually going to do it all programmatically. We'll do the entire thing in code. So here I've got this worker role. Okay, and here's where the code starts down here on start. And right down in here, I create my new Cloud Blob client. Okay, specifying true. I am going to use the development storage for this one. Okay, and then I specify that I want to get a container reference for drives. If I jump back over here to my studio, you'll notice here I've got a container called drives right there. That's where it's going to go. Okay, and that's actually the one up in the cloud. But here, if I go into this one and jump down here to development storage, you'll notice this is my development storage drives location. Okay, so that's on my machine right here. And so that's where the page blob is going to go. It's going to go right in there. Okay? And then what I do is I just call, you know, I call create blob client, and then I get a container reference to drives, and I create it if it doesn't exist. And then I say initialize my cloud drive cache. Obviously, every time you write a file to this thing, you don't want it to go do blobs, you know, stuff. You don't want it to be writing to the blob. So you can have what's called a cache, an in-memory cache, basically, where this stuff is being written, and then periodically it gets flushed and saved. So you want that, and you can specify the size of that cache and how that cache behaves. And then down here, we actually create the cloud drive. There's a class called Cloud Storage Account. I get my development storage account and call create cloud drive. And notice I'm specifying this URL. This is on my dev fabric here on my machine. So I'm saying dev store account drives mycloudrive.vhd. That's the name of the page blob in this case. Okay, and then down here I can just call create on that thing, on that drive. I'm saying I want it to be 64 megabytes in size. The smallest size you can create is 16 megabytes, but you can make them quite large if you'd like. After that's done, I'll write out to my trace that this new drive was created. And then down here, I'll mount it. I just say mycloudrive.mount, and I can specify that the mount will happen. And then down here, I'll write out my Azure drive was mounted on, and then I print out that drive letter right there. Okay, so the call to mount gives me my drive letter back, and then that's where I know it is. Okay. So that all happens in the on start call. And then up here, up above, in the run, which gets called, you know, every so often, this thing is actually just running in a loop. Sorry, that gets called after start, and that just keeps spinning for 10 seconds every time. And then I'm just going to write, every time this thing happens, I'm just going to go through this for loop 5 times, and I'm going to create a new GUID, put that in a string, and I'm just basically creating a new text file within that drive. And then I say write all to text, and I'm just writing it to a file, just using system.io. And then I write out to my diagnostics trace, hey, I just wrote this file out with this particular name. Okay, and then I can snapshot that drive every time if I want to create copies of it. So to run this thing, I'm just going to do an F5. That's going to take this worker role application in Windows Azure, and it's going to deploy it into my dev fabric on my box. It's a lot faster to do it this way than to actually try to do it up in the Windows Azure cloud. So right now it's deployed it, it's packaged it all up. If I come over here and I right click, usually it'll pop up a little toast down there so you can see this just happened. But if I bring up my development fabric, this gives you some visibility into that thing. And notice it's already happening. mounted Azure Drive on, right here, if you look, mounted Azure Drive on A. Okay, right there. And then file written, and you see it's writing files out. And it's actually doing it every 10 seconds. They keep coming in there. And we're just writing files out, just like we're writing to a file system. If you right-click on this thing, this instance, and say open local store, you can actually browse out here, and you can look at that mounted drive. And there's all the files that are going into it. Okay, with GUIDs for file names that we created. If I double-click on one of those, you'll see testing from dev days, just like we wrote in the code. Okay, so that's a pretty compelling feature, in my opinion. If you have apps that you're trying to, you know, move over to Windows Azure, and they're all right, and a lot of them write to the file system, and it's going to be a big pain to kind of move all that to just regular blob storage, this is kind of an easy way, an easy migration technique to make that possible. I'm sorry? Is it going over port 80? Is that the question? Yeah, in this case, it's talking to the cloud service through the normal cloud APIs. Okay, but it's using a page blob to do it more efficiently. If it did the whole blob every time, that would be very inefficient. So it uses the page blob techniques, and it's basically using some kind of optimized algorithm on top of that to push the data out there. Okay, so now let's jump back to the slides here. We're basically done at this point, but I want to show you two more things. I'm just going to show you two more examples. I want to first show you kind of a complete example that's in the SDK that's a good summary of everything that we just talked about. It's called the Guestbook app. If you go into the Windows Azure SDK after you install it, just remember this one, Guestbook, and it's just one solution with a few different projects in it that are all Windows Azure roles. And they basically give you this notion of a guestbook that you would sign at a wedding or something. And you can sign your name and upload a photo, and then it's going to go up there. Okay, so if I actually run this thing and deploy it, let me just show you what it looks like real quick. This thing is going to bring up a web app that was built in ASP.NET using C#. And that web app just gives you a simple form for entering a name, a message, and a photo. Okay, and then you upload it, you press a button, it's going to upload all that stuff. And then once that happens, that ASP.NET page is going to do a couple of things. It's going to add an entry to table storage. For each one of these entries, we're going to have a row in our table. We have a table for all these guestbook entries. And each row is going to consist of, you know, a name, a message, and a photo reference, a photo URL, okay, along with a unique ID. And so we're just adding these things in, and then we just bind to that thing and build this page. That's how this particular app works. But then what happens is, you know, people can upload these big photos that aren't the right size. And so I want to, on demand, when people upload these things, you know, have another process that's kind of sitting over here just running all the time, looking for work to do. And whenever we upload a photo, we're just going to put a message into a queue saying, hey, I just got a new photo. Go resize it to the optimal size for our guestbook. So we're using queues, too. And then I have a worker role app that's sitting over there that's just monitoring the queue, waiting for those things to show up. And whenever a message shows up, it says, oh, got a new resize request, and it gets a reference to the row in the table. And so then that worker role will go and pull that record out of the table, look for the URL, then it goes and grabs that blob down, resizes it, puts it back, and then notifies saying, I'm done. And then the thing will just automatically refresh. So this example uses all of those pieces we just talked about. I won't walk through all the code, but it's going to look just like the code we just wrote. And it'd be a good exercise to just kind of walk through it and see it. So let's just sign in here for Keith. And see what it looks like. I'll grab a picture of Keith here off my desktop. There's a JPEG, and then we'll click on the pencil to sign in. And then notice that picture is really big right now, and you know that row's there. It just did a data bind against that table again. And here in a few seconds, we should see it resized. That request went over into a queue. The worker role picked it up. Once the resize is done, now we have our resized picture. Okay, so that's a good example of kind of how all these things work in a typical Azure app where you're communicating between them. One last thing I want to show you is SQL Azure. Okay, we got just 2 minutes left, so let me jump over here to my Windows Azure portal again and click on SQL Azure. Now, this is totally different than everything else we just talked about. Everything we talked about is part of a Windows Azure account, the core account. When you get one of those accounts, you can start doing storage. Okay, if you want to do SQL Azure, that's a separate account. I mean, you basically are buying a different thing, and you're going to pay by the month for these things. Okay, they have two editions of the database. They have a web edition, which is $9 a month, $9, and they have a business edition, which is $99 a month. And the difference between them is size. The web edition is only 1 gigabyte in size, and the business edition is 10 gigabytes. But that's as big as these get right now. So you can't go bigger than 10. So if you have databases that are bigger than this, you can just tune out for the rest of the talk, even though there's only 7 seconds left. And that's basically what you get, right? So what you do is you come in here and you just create databases. So I can come in here and just click on Create Database, create as many databases as I want, that specify the size there. You're going to get charged for each one. Okay, and then once you have a database there, you can just start connecting to it. For this particular database, there's my server name, there's my admin username, and the server location where this thing actually resides. I can also set up firewall restrictions to control which IP addresses are allowed to even talk to this thing. And if I want to, I can add in additional rules here, and I can always just grab the connection strings for this particular database to actually go connect to it inside of SQL Server. I can test the connectivity here by providing my credentials, and I can grab that connection string. And that's what I'd copy to my clipboard, and that's what you'll now use in your app, that connection string right there. Right? It should look very familiar. And once you change the connection string, everything else in your app should just work. It won't, but it should. Okay? You'll get really close. There's some things in SQL Server that are not supported yet today. They're documented on MSDN. But the majority of SQL Server just works. They've tried to make it that way, so you can take pretty much any common SQL Server database, as long as you're not doing crazy, wacky stuff, and you can just put it out there. And so just as an example, let me bring up SQL. I'll bring up the SQL Management Studio. Okay, and this is the R2 release. You've got to be using the R2 release for this to work. But then notice I'm connecting to that Azure database. Okay, that's some random random ID .database.windows.net. That's the one that they gave me over here. If you remember in my Windows Azure account, let me close this and we come up here. Notice that, didn't mean to do that. Let me jump back up there. Oh, I apologize. Oh. Okay, this right here, if I can get that. That database name is the same as the one you're looking at right here in this one. And now we're just going to connect, and Management Studio is now connecting out. Oh, and it's not going to work for me right now because I need to add an IP address. Right now I've got the thing completely locked down. Let me just show you. I'll just add in a firewall rule. So I'll say add rule. It actually shows me what my current IP address is. Makes it nice and convenient to just add that in. And hit submit. And once that takes effect, we should be able to come back over here and just connect. And now we're in. And it's going to, give me a very natural SQL Server experience. And I see in here I've got this database called Sconnard. In here, I've got a whole bunch of tables. This is actually just Northwind. I can right-click on this thing, and I can, script the table. Let's do a select, and we'll just bring this in and run this query real quick. And there's data coming straight down from SQL Azure. Okay? So Microsoft has tried very, very carefully here to provide a lot of different options for storage. Right, you've got the massively highly scalable options through blobs, through tables, and through queues. And you have this more traditional relational model, which by its very nature is not very scalable. But if you want to make it really easy to provision SQL servers, get them up there, and have Microsoft deal with all the management around those things, you'll have backups and copies of all that stuff too, of your databases. It's guaranteed to not go away, right? It will be there when you come back. And if a server goes down, a new one will be brought up and it's just automatically handled. That's the benefit of using SQL Azure. Okay? So that's it. And if you have any other questions, just feel free to come on up. I know I'm out of time, so I don't want to hold the whole group up with questions, but I hope you enjoyed Dev Days. Take care.